with a prayerfulness, with a strong dedication, will lift the mind and the emotions from the intranquility of daily living. We also realize that faith is therapeutic. The faith is probably the basis of releasing the love of God into the body of man, to make possible the reconstruction of the body, to help its restoration wherever this is possible. And of course, the faith factor is merely existing because of man's internal love and respect for the divine plan of which he is a part. Therefore, it is very important to realize that various emotions have inevitable consequences. And wherever an emotional attitude is wrong, the consequences will be harmful. Harmful to the individual, to his family, to his community, to his world, and to the universe itself. Each person who allows his own pressures to escape from a simple veneration for life will have trouble. We know that today a great deal is being done on a psychological level to experiment with these mysteries. And we have also very definite evidence that the emotional pressures of the individual can destroy him. They can also destroy him slowly and painfully. They can bring upon him one misery and misfortune after another. The individual who has not directed and purified his own emotional life is like the man with whom it was said that cowards die many times, brave men but once. We are constantly building up problems, and then we are wondering how they develop. We may even shake our fist at heaven and blame it for our troubles. But actually, uncontrolled attitudes are to blame. All attitudes that are selfish or destructive are wrong. There is no such thing as righteous indignation. All concepts to the contrary, notwithstanding. Righteous indignation is not the answer to any problem. Insight is the answer. Indignation, anger, the tendency to revenge, the feeling that we must hurt someone that hurts us, these are all contrary to the divine plan. Now, we would be a little hesitant going out in an automobile that is out of order, or going out and facing physical things that are wrong. We would be very careful if we were in the jungle, not to be left alone with wild animals. We would take every possible physical means to secure ourselves. But what is much more important is the individual securing his own inner life, bringing it into a pattern which will not turn and bite him. And the world is full of individuals who have been bitten by their own mistakes. So good book tells us, and experience tells us, that there is only one essential bond of human relationship. One of the classic statements of Mohandas Gandhi was that there will never be peace in this world until all human beings are bound together with nothing stronger than the silken thread of love. Love is the only answer. We've been working with hate for centuries, and therefore hate has grown and become a very luxurious type of plant, but it will never bring peace. You can never fight your way to peace in yourself or in the world. Many changes may have to take place in society before the human being is capable of realizing this. But do not forget that in a certain number of years, you are going to depart from this society. You're going to leave a world that is run by selfishness and aggression for the most part. And you are going into a world where these values no longer exist. Your only passport to the larger world is the degree of unselfish love that has been allowed to develop within your own nature. You're going to a place where All of your ambitions, as you know them today on this material plane, are worthless. In that other way of life, aspiration takes precedence over ambition. The individual is rewarded according to the development of his own internal values, and his treasures, which are stored up in heaven, are peace of heart, peace of mind, generosity of spirit, and simple, natural love of God and all that lives. These are the only attitudes you can take with you. Now, it is a mistake to assume that when you flip off this mortal coil, you will automatically have all these virtues. There are several old stories. There's one story about a banker, and this, by the way, goes back to Egypt, about a banker who had lived his entire life banking. So when the time came for him to pass into the next life, the judges of these matters looked him over carefully, and they found out that he didn't know much about anything except banking. So they did the only thing they could. He'd been an honest banker. He hadn't cheated people, but he just had no other interest. So they said, the only way we can make a heaven for this man is to set him up in a banking house. So they got a table, money-changing table. They gave him scales and coins and a comfortable chair and a pad of paper, the papyrus in those days, and they told him to go into business. So for century after century, he loaned money, got it back, improved the sureties, in a world of dreams of his own. He never actually knew what had happened to him, really. He just thought he'd left one banking house and gone into another. And finally, when the time came for him to be reborn again, he just closed that banking house and came back. There was no understanding, no contact with the life of the spirit beyond, because he didn't have it. Now, the only way we can transform the after-death state from a rather monotonous continuation of our present attitude is to get rid of the attitudes while we're here. We want to get more natural inquiry. We want to have a more sincere interest in learning and understanding and expanding consciousness and unfolding the spiritual aspects of our lives, so that when we do come into a larger world, we come as adventurers looking for new things, looking for something better. And our future will be fortunate if in this process we have not become self-centered, but have desired most of all to understand and share in the divine love. Under those conditions, we won't be stuck behind the banking table in the next life. We will go on and grow. But if we have nothing to take with us but our mistakes, this probably inspired the Egyptians to their idea of purgatory. Purgatory was nothing but a place of purifying. And it might take a long time to purify the individual from his materialistic inclinations, even after you've left this world. So the time to start universal citizenship is now, fully realizing that if you have to sacrifice a little of the physical satisfaction, that we are only here for a limited period of time, that we are citizens of eternity forever. And it is our citizenship there that is important. But because this veil of matter conceals us from that larger life, we are unaware of the reality of these things. The simplest devotions that we have, which inspire perhaps an understanding, is the maternal instinct, one of the most important, the love of mother for child. That very close communion of a parent with a little life coming into manifestation. This can be probably one of the purest forms of love known in the world. It is a form of love in which there is really no thought of self, perhaps no thought of separateness. But there is the wonder of beholding this little one coming into life gradually, unfolding its potentials, and very dependent upon human assistance for the fulfillment of its activities. Now, there is a certain peculiar dependency in which deity is dependent upon humanity. Humanity is the only power, the only form, the only way in which deity can perfect its own humanity. Deity moving into manifestation, bringing with it its natural and beautiful rules and laws, has probably its highest expression in our physical life in human beings. Here we have the direct instrument, the realization that the divine power is coming gradually to birth in us. We see it perhaps almost as we would see a newborn babe. But what we may not realize is that within this newborn babe, as within the physical one in our own family, the most important factor is deity itself. In each of us is a spark of the divine. In each new child, that spark is again brought into manifestation. God moving into matter finally rises through the lower forms of matter to achieve its first self-expression in humanity. We are therefore burdened with a very deep and beautiful responsibility. It is our privilege to make obvious, to release, to bring into manifestation every beautiful thing that is in the heart of God. It is our privilege to become servants in this house of eternity and to become more and more aware of our partnership with deity in the perfection of the divine form. But we have gradually lost sight of these things. And as intimate personal problems become more burdensome, we lose faith, we lose hope. And gradually, the problem of survival in a very complex society takes over and controls us. We are warned, however, that those who would save their lives shall lose them. But those who lose their lives in the service of truth shall have life everlasting. And it is gradually a matter of whether or not we want to save that which is the good in ourselves, whether we want to truly release out of our own nature the potential of beauty that is there. Now, there are certain other simple little things that we can bear in mind that always help. One is that the individual cannot live entirely on a one-pointed mental attitude. There is too much pressure. Therefore, every individual who has an economic or physical problem should also have some kind of an aesthetic avocational interest. He should have some way to compensate for the intensity of the problems of physical survival by some thing that brings with it a release toward truth, something that gives him a new and fuller reason for life, that he escapes from the pressure of one purpose, even though that purpose may be very noble. He must have variety. He must have always a door leading out of the material world into something better. If he is positive here in this world, there must be a window through which he can look out into that larger world. This window is creative imagination. This window is the power for the individual to see something beyond matter. He must have some vision of a larger world and a larger purpose and a greater destiny. Therefore, through whatever creative self-expression he may have, he may gain gradually the realization of the importance of having not only a well-ordered material life, but a material life that is rich in constructive overtones. If he is serving himself with part of his life, he must serve others with another part of his life. If he is thinking of his own advancement, he must never forget the common good. If he wants to be a better person, he must make some contribution to the betterness of those around him. He must have dedication. He must have charity, which is one of the associate terms. Love being termed charity. Charity is not only giving to the poor. Charity is the forgiving of the mistakes of others. It is the individual freeing his mind from various antagonisms and chronic memories by simply forgiving those that have in any way injured him. Perhaps he only thinks they did, but he can at least forgive his own thought on the subject. Whatever he does, there must be, with love, a certain forgiveness, a certain realization that the individual can be bigger than the things that happen to him, can have greater insight than is shown by a person who is ultimately and utterly bound up with his own projects, his own attitudes. So charity begins in the forgiveness of others, a broadness toward life, an overcoming of prejudices, an overcoming of intolerances, a recognition of value wherever it is and whoever has it, and most of all, a continually seeking after greater value. To understand better is to love better. And that which may begin with indifference can be developed and perfected into affection through understanding. Everywhere we are looking for friendship, for kindliness, for the relation of things that is not brittle, not forced, not destructive. And as the persons who work with this problem, we can do a great deal with it. Now, one thing that many people have discovered over the period of time is that it's very, very important to vocalize a conviction. When we keep it locked within ourselves, very often we can't even state it correctly. But if we can take a beautiful thought and express it, if we can say to ourselves that we do have love of our fellow men, and that we do love deity, and that we are dedicated to the services of value, if we think this, it's very good. But sometimes it is better to come right out and have a verbal statement of it. Strangely enough, something mysterious happens when we put thoughts into words. The thoughts that come out of our mouths go around the sides and go back to our ears. And we believe them better when they come that way. There's a great authority in what we hear or what we see. But there's not as much authority in really what we think. The thoughts are too diffuse to begin with. And wherever we have some type of religious devotion, it is very good for us to restate audibly, or in writing, or both, that which we hold to be most important. If we really wish to convert ourselves, we must use every possible instrument of conversion, because against it is a static pressure from ages of environmental circumstances. We are trying to overcome a world around us, and the only way we can do it is to establish firmly the world within us. So it is very useful sometimes to actually verbalize a conviction. If we really believe that love is a divine power, we should state it to ourselves. And in stating it to ourselves, we should try to image it in ourselves. We should not leave it as a strange word that has 100 meanings. We should leave it only as a term to represent the inevitable relationships of living things. It is the ultimate relationship. It is next to identity. And the more affection we have, the closer we come to identification with those who are the objects of our affection. And the more completely our affection is spiritualized, the closer we come to identity with the one eternal love that governs everything. We gradually can create an auto-suggestive remedy for a number of our defects. We can very definitely and intentionally re-verbalize. We can also think, and I think the average person would do better that whenever there are a few quiet moments, when he's waiting in the doctor's office or whether he's sitting around or trying to keep his mind on television, that if in those moments he would choose silence. And wherever there is quietude and aloneness, where the pressures of the outside can be controlled or reduced, to restate every day a number of times the real meaning of love, the idea of bestowing self upon those that need, giving without hope of return, doing what would be, as far as we can do it, the work that God would have us do. And in this type of thing, gradually to create an image of our relationship with life, an image based upon an enduring and eternal friendship, a relationship which also gradually unfolds to us more and more of the mysteries of the universal plan. When we love the universal plan, it will open up. It will reveal more and more of its mysteries. It responds to this far more than it responds to intellectual investigation. The scientist can keep on exploring space, but he will never find the answer until he learns to love space and recognize in it the source of all things for all creatures. It is this bridging of intellectual concept with a simple, gentle, warm emotion of regard, respect, adoration that opens most of the doors that stand closed to us at the present time. For there is nothing in the world that brings greater internal peace than to look around and find nothing to hate. Now, we may have to, for a moment, imagine that there are things to hate. It may sound much too platitudinous to say there is nothing to hate. Why shouldn't we hate despotism? Why shouldn't we hate cruelty? We can regret them. We can, in our own minds and hearts, realize how much better things would be if these things faded away. But when we energize our sadness by a tremendous viciousness of reaction, we have missed the point entirely. Corruption is not something to be hated. It is something to be gradually brought back into line with truth. It is something that must, in course of time, change its ways. And if man is unable to change these ways, the divine plan will change. Because in the nature of things, the entire universal existence is essentially an expression of love. It is an expression of love made possible through law. And the way of training little living things, from the smallest to the greatest, is through discipline. And we discipline the emotions by keeping them beautiful. We discipline the mind by keeping it reasonable. And we discipline, in a certain sense, our own inner character by bringing it under the rule of moderation in all things. I think it's important that every person should set aside a certain amount of time, it's only a minute or two, to a quiet contemplation of the purposes of the divine will, to reaffirm that it is more important, most important, that we are all on God's side. It is up to us to try in every way that we can to expand our own integrities, because integrity is not to be gained from the mind alone, nor are we going to be saved by wisdom alone. But all these other things, knowledge, skills, all this, these are only instruments for the expression of something else. And the final summary of all knowledge is this simple recognition of the identity of life, that everything is one, and all things in varying degrees are trying to outgrow isolation and restore the realization of their common unity. We are not separate creatures. We are aspects of one life. We do not have separate lives or separate minds, finally. We are all having only relative relationships with the divine faculties and powers which flow into manifestation through us. We are one being. We are one life, indivisible. We are one purpose that can never be completely destroyed by selfishness or by antagonism. But because we are indivisible, actually love is only a recognition of this. Love is a sudden realization of our inevitable relationship with every other living thing. Love is that which impels us sometimes to overlook the faults in others, because they say love is blind. But even if love be blind, it has within it a tremendous healing power. And when love is there, and it's really working, and it's really functioning, it can open its eyes. And it can see that its dreams of beauty were not exaggerated. And love makes everything more beautiful. Love wrinkles out the tired patterns of years. Love makes all things new. And in this newness, we begin to see not the outside natures of things, but the inside nature shining through. And when we are able to see the internal light of those we care for shining through, it would be almost impossible for us to resist the impulse to bring admiration, adoration to these persons who are around us, but who are actually only ourselves. We are all one life. To realize that is to finally find our destiny. And the most important factor is bringing things together to overcome differences, to overcome separateness, to rise for at least a moment above the material pressures of living. The emotion of affection is the greatest therapy, the greatest mystery that we have. It is a very mysterious emotion, probably the most mysterious. The reason it is mysterious is because it arises in the mystery of the divine nature itself. We cannot actually fathom that divine nature to its core. We can, however, trace it back from the commonplace to many very noble and beautiful things. But we cannot find the exact definition of that which exists only in the divine being. But we can see it flowing out of that divine being. And it is like a living water, for love nourishes everything and hate destroys. Love gradually flowing makes the whole world fertile. It brings all things to the fullness of themselves. It helps us to lead children to the fullness of their lives. It helps us to assist those in trouble to such relief and relief as we can bestow upon them. Our faith has the sacraments of marriage, of baptism. It has the sacraments of unction. All these things were fashioned to reveal the love of God and to bind man to that love by disciplines. Disciplines not intended to frustrate the individual, but disciplines suitable to bring him, his life into harmony with the divine plan, which is the fullness of all life. We are not supposed to be frustrated creatures in a world of infinite opportunity. We are rather intended to be magnificent creatures of opportunity in a world which at the present moment is mostly frustration. The frustration is on circumstances, not on ourselves. If we can unfold and develop and perfect our own natures, we can then gradually reach out and we'll find that love is not ultimately personal at all, any more than life is. All things share in life. All things share in the potential of love. And as we learn to share in it and share with it, many of the problems which we now try to intellectualize do not need to be intellectualized. For just a kind thought and a kind word can overcome hours of mental struggle and conflict. There is nothing to love more rapid and more important than the forgiveness of the mistakes of others and the disciplining of our own lives. The doctrine of redemption by grace means that the grace in us redeems us, and the grace we show to others helps to build the better world we all wish to live in. It is something to start in with and work with to the best of our abilities every day. And whenever we see of strife or conflict arising, quieten down and try to see how you can help truth to manifest through a difficult situation. If you can do this and do it consistently, you will have a much happier and more useful life. And we need this type of thinking at the moment where practically the whole world is involved in discords which are not necessary, but which are the inevitable result of the individual placing physical values first and not guarding and guiding physical values by the proper use of metaphysical principles. It is only when the divine comes down here through us that the mistakes that are common to humanity can be completely rectified and solved. So it's a great challenge, it's a great mystery, but it's very beautiful. Thank you very much.